Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs within the U.S. Department of Defense. So, Dr. Woodson, would you elaborate on the historic outcomes derived from the success of the Joint Trauma System over the last 15 years? How does military medicine build on these successes, sustain this excellence, and most of all, institutionalize the lessons learned?
So one of the clear issues about getting superior outcomes in trauma care has to be that you have to build a system. It's not about individuals, the surgeon or the medic or the nurse. It's about how they work together across time and space that is, in fact, focused on the optimal outcomes, saving lives, basically. We knew from experience in the civilian sector at the beginning of the war that cities were beginning to organize these trauma systems to include the emergency medical systems and the hospitals to better optimize the flow of patients, the outcomes, and to look at metrics to really define that outcomes were improving. At the beginning of the war, there were a number of folks who got together and said, we need to do this, particularly since we were moving patients more rapidly through the continuum of care from the point of injury to resuscitative centers in theater to launch stool to the United States. So the Joint Trauma System really represents a synchronized set of capabilities from the point of injury through the rehabilitative process that connects all of the pieces in a way that improves outcomes. And in fact, you may know that certainly an individual who reaches the first echelon of care, who's injured on a battlefield today and reaches the first echelon of care, has an excess of 93% chance of surviving, and probably greater than 95, as the new data would suggest. That means that we understand what the medics are doing, what they need to be trained on. We know what the tactical helicopters need to have in terms of equipment and skill sets of the medics on board. We know now what the forward surgical teams need to do and what they should not be doing. So it's about damage control surgery. It's about immediate resuscitation and then moving them on to the Roll 3 hospitals where more definitive care is. But it's also about then not letting the individual languish there, but then transporting them with critical care aeromedical capability to launch and then on to home to definitive centers. So the Joint Trauma System is just that, a system that allows you to mine data in almost real time to improve the system. Now, your question also asked how we're institutionalizing that. And so we are defining a strategy with the joint staff to even analyze the Joint Trauma System further, looking forward to the future to see what new capabilities we need to put in place. But it is now clearly institutionalized in the joint system with collaboration of the DHA and the services, and will be part of our ongoing strategy to deliver care in any future missions.
So, Doctor, during your tenure, you mentioned you have made a specific effort of focusing on strengthening military medicine's global health engagement. And I'd like to focus a little bit more on that. And could you tell us specifically what it entails, this effort, as a tool of soft power, maybe smart power, and more particularly, perhaps you could highlight some of the things you're most proud of in this area.
Yes. So global health engagement is this emerging concept that we can, through health diplomacy, through health engagement around the world, build bridges help create the elements of stable societies, because when societies and countries invest in health, that's really a marker that they are more stable. It's a reflection of their value system, a reflection of their priorities. It's a reflection of investing in their people. It's a reflection of, in fact, that they're considering the future of their people when they invest in health. And global health engagement in concept is that if you invest engagement around the world, you actually elevate the reputation of America in helping individual nations and regions achieve their health goal. Oh, by the way, you also help protect America, because when you build public health capacity so that they can prevent, detect, and respond to disease outbreak, you don't get a situation where you get Ebola and then people get on planes and it's on the shores of America. So there is a national security element to this, but it is about the use of this soft power to build bridges. So it's good diplomacy. It's good for security, and it is a way, I believe, of helping to lessen the potential for kinetic operations because you have built these bridges. Now, I want to emphasize that the U.S. military doesn't do this alone. It actually is a part player in the whole of U.S. government. And in fact, there may be other agencies that have and should take the lead, whether it's state USAID or Health and Human Services. But we have very strong assets and capabilities that we bring to this endeavor. And so we needed to recognize our responsibilities in this area. We needed to define our requirements. We needed to create a cadre of individuals who could support these interactions with the right competencies. And then we needed to provide a forum for academic exploration to say, what is it we should be doing? How is it we should be doing it? And what should we look forward in the future? So we've established at the Uniformed Services University a global health engagement department, which brings in the resources of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. We've developed within the Department of Defense a global health engagement council of deputies to the assistant secretaries so that we can coordinate activities and have better situational awareness and therefore provide better input to the secretary and chairman in terms of these matters. And it's already shown the promise that when you have issues pop up around the world, whether it's Zika or something else, having this better coordination and situational awareness really does allow for processing of information better and the development of input for strategy a lot sooner.
So I'd like to focus internally a little bit, and that is on medical readiness, a healthy and fit force. What are you doing in that area? What are some of the programs, some of the efforts you've pursued? And more particularly, how have you sort of used 21st century technology and tools to engage a medical ready and healthy and fit force?
So, you know, one of our strategies or one of the things we tried to promote during my tenure was to move from a system of just healthcare, which is providing treatments after you have established injuries or diseases, to a system of health, of promoting health, which was focusing on the population and all of those prevention issues that prevent disease and illness and injury. And so what you need to do is encourage and enhance your public health strategy and platform. And it takes on a whole different tone when you talk about health. It takes on involvement of many more stakeholders and communities. So we promoted and supported the development of the Healthy Base Initiative, for example, which was a pilot attempt at looking at 14 routine installations and doing holistic environmental scans of what was going on in terms of promotion of health, of sort of everything from exercise areas to vending machines to vendors and what kind of food they were offering to leadership attitudes. You know, we found in some places, for example, that bases not consciously, perhaps, but by design, would promote the use of using your car from moving from one part of the base to the other because there weren't any sidewalks, for example. So someone who wanted to go over to the shopping area and worked in one of the installation buildings would get in their car and drive the mile rather than walk the mile, basically. Simple things like that. When you do the environmental scans for nutrition and you look at what's in the vending machines and what the fast food places were offering, there was an opportunity for a lot of improvement and to use our buying power as sort of a forcing function to improve menus and the like. So those are the kinds of things that we were investing in, as well as, of course, education of the troops and how to live healthier lives, support of families and how to live healthier lives as a family unit.
As we close, what accomplishments are you most proud of during your tenure? What's next for you?
Again, I think my proudest accomplishment was, again, being a servant leader in support of the 150,000 men and women of the military health system and giving them a new set of strategies and organizational environment to succeed in the future. And it's all the things that we talked about. I think I have supported the Office of the Secretary of Defense well. Now, as I go into the future and back into private life, I'm heading back to academic life. I'll be going back to Boston University, where I will be establishing a new Health Systems Innovation and Policy Institute there, and resuming clinical duties and be a professor of surgery, public health, and practice. So,
sir, I've had the pleasure of sort of bookending your career as Assistant Secretary. I had you on in the beginning of your tenure, and now that you're in. And I just want to ask, what advice would you give someone who is thinking about a career in either medicine or public service, or ideally both?
So I think ideally both, frankly. And so that's a great question. I've always subscribed to the Jeffersonian concept of democracy, where people come from private life into government service but go back to private life. I think that renews the blood of not only you as a person but what you contribute to government because it's not about protecting your job. Job in government, it's about serving and then going back into private life. And then if you have the opportunity to serve again, you do that. So the advice I would give is to young people is build your toolkit. You'll never know when the call will come. You'll need a broad set of skills, not only your medical skills, but your ability to be a leader, to work in teams, and to understand how government runs, as complex as it is, to make improvements. But by all means, look forward to an opportunity to serve in some public way.
Well, Dr. Woodson, I want to thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule as you're wrapping up your time at DOD. But from one New York University alum to the other, I want to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure being here.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs within the U.S. Department of Defense. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.